Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, the radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, I told you a moment ago that I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law, and I tell you that every week, and it's true. That's where I teach constitutional law most of the year. However, for the past 4 years, maybe five now, I can't keep it straight, I've had the privilege also of teaching constitutional law at the University of Tennessee during their summer semester. And I always enjoy getting over to Knoxville in the summer, and I enjoy the faculty there. Hello, faculty. They're wonderful people. And I also enjoy meeting a different group of students. And this past summer, I had the pleasure of teaching 20, 25 students there. And among them was a young man by the name of Tyler. And Tyler so enjoyed the class that he asked me at one point, may I please bring in my girlfriend? Now, this is an unusual request. I mean, people don't generally ask if they can just bring friends into class to listen in. And I said, well, sure, but why? And he said, well, she's from Slovenia. And she is trying to learn all about the United States, and I think this is just exactly the sort of thing she'd like to hear. And so within a day or so, young Maya showed up in class. And Maya, I must tell you, is a lovely young woman. I'm talking about the whole package. She's, of course, a pleasant appearance, but I'm just saying she's just a lovely person. She's very pleasant. She smiled. And guess what? Tyler was right. She was fascinated by American constitutional history. She paid very close attention, much closer, I must say, than some of my law students. And she also had lots of questions. And so we really enjoyed having Maya in class from time to time. And I noticed at one particular class session that she really perked up. And I wasn't entirely sure why this was true until subsequently Tyler told me so. He said, you know, Professor Harris, you mentioned what she's studying. You mentioned wine. And I had to think for a minute because wine is not typically something I mention in constitutional law class. But then I realized he was talking about a particular type of wine, a particular type of wine that many of the founders of our nation particularly enjoyed. And this was a wine called Madeira. Madeira wine. I mentioned it because George Washington enjoyed it. I mentioned it because Thomas Jefferson seemed to enjoy it in great quantity. But I also mentioned it because Madeira wine was favored by perhaps the most important Chief Justice of the United States in all of U.S. history. His name was John Marshall. He was not the first Chief Justice. He was actually the fourth, but he served for 34 or 35 years early in the 19th century, and he was the justice who put together overwhelming majorities in favor of some of the most important cases in all of American constitutional law. How did he do this? Well, the historians tell us that he had a congenial personality. The historians tell us that he made a point of having all the justices room together in the same rooming house, that he had a point of having them all dine together so that they got to know each other. So there was a certain degree of conviviality, and that this led to more consensus on the court. The historians also tell us that part of the conviviality involved, you guessed it, Madeira wine. In fact, on a trip to John Marshall's house in Richmond some years ago, I saw his cask of Madeira wine on rollers. Get this, on rollers. And he would literally pull this behind him and bring it with him on his travels. He was kind of like the frat guy who shows up with the beer. And as we all know, that frat guy is the most popular guy at the party. Well, John Marshall brought not the beer, but the wine. And because he brought the wine, and because he was such a nice fellow, and because he was so persuasive, we have many of the cases that have built American constitutional law. So you see, it is a constitutional subject. But there's also a mystery, isn't there? How many of you have heard about Madeira? Have you ever tried Madeira wine? I'm not a wine expert, but I had never actually been offered a glass of this stuff. In fact, for some reason, I thought it had sort of disappeared. Well, young Maya took it upon herself to go out and begin researching this, and that takes a little explanation, too. Maya is actually studying geography at the University of Tennessee. She is a graduate student, and specifically the geography of wine. How's that for a major? At any rate, Maya went out and studied Madeira wine and came back in and was so enthusiastic about it and wanted to sit down and tell me all about it that after I listened to her for only a minute or two, I realized that you would want to listen to her as well. So without further ado, let's talk to Maya and let's talk about the mystery of Madeira wine.
My name is Maya Giorgio. My last name, it's not Slovenian, it's Macedonian.
Macedonia.
So
okay.
Also Slovenian people have problems to pronounce this sometimes. So
even in Slovenia, you have a hard to pronounce
exactly.
last name. So what part of Slovenia are you from?
Well, I like to say I'm from the coastal region of Slovenia because that's how I really feel like being from there. I lived there for the last 5 years.
Right.
But I was born inland, more to like northeast of Slovenia.
Now for the geographically challenged among us, remind us where Slovenia is.
Where Slovenia, it's part of Central Europe, or mm-hmm. some people put it in Southeastern Europe.
What we call the Balkans, right?
Balkans countries, was
right.
former... part of former Yugoslav Republic.
Yugoslavia. Okay, that'll help most people. And that if so, I recall, is across the Adriatic from Italy, right?
Yeah, it bordered to Italy on the west, on north with Austria, east with Hungary, and south with Croatia.
Okay, so now we know where you're from.
Yes.
And you got very interested in this coastal region of Slovenia in a very particular subject. What is that subject?
Well, that subject is primarily related to wine.
Wine.
But as
so, how does that differ from someone who simply likes to drink a lot?
It's different because I actually approach this from different perspective. Because first, I like wine by myself, and second of all, I am a geographer, and I see a complexity of this.
Oh, I see. So you're studying wine. You're
I'm
not just
studying
drinking wine.
I'm not just drinking wine.
In fact, it's that study of geography that brings you here to the United States, isn't it?
That was primarily the reason why I'm here, because I am a student now at University of Tennessee.
In the geography department?
Geography department. I'm mm-hmm. a graduate student there. But I'm specializing wine geography. So I'm interested in studying wine regions and everything what influence on the production of wine.
You know, and I am realizing that I have a misspent youth. I should have majored in beer geography.
This is very interesting study.
Very interesting very study interesting. In college. And then I could have combined my major extracurricular activity with my academic pursuits and gotten college credit for it.
But
I admire you, Maya.
You would really need to sacrifice yourself to do a lot of tasting.
I see that. Well, you know, somehow I think I could have lived up to that challenge. All right, so you're studying wine geography. Now, what is wine geography?
Wine geography, it's geography of wine regions, of wine, of grape and wine production. So, as French call this, it's called terroir. And terroir, it's a word for different... like all the impact that influence on the wine production. So we are talking about soil influences, climate, region, history, culture, and the winemaker by itself.
Do you think you'd like to go into winemaking later in life, or are you simply going to continue your studies, or do you have academic pursuits in mind? What does one do
well,
with a graduate degree in wine geography?
When one can do a lot of things,
uh-huh.
I'm interested in both, mm-hmm. but definitely I want to spend some time also like actually in vineyards to see, you know, how grapes are grown, how wine is made. I already spend a lot of time in wineries, in the vineyards, but, you know, when you're there for a year or two, when you actually, you know, go through all the seasons and see what happened in the vineyard and in the wine cellar, then you really get a good understanding in that.
Wow, that is a fascinating subject. Now, of course, people might be wondering why in the world we're talking on a show about the Constitution about wine. So let me do just a little bit of explaining there. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you've been attending my summer class in constitutional law at the University of Tennessee with your friend, who is Tyler Roy, who is one of my law students. And we're very happy to have you because you have an interest in constitutional law, and that's fantastic. Many of our listeners do, too. But it was during our conversations in that class that I happened to mention, I think it was I who brought it up, the subject of a particular type of wine, Madeira wine, which was very popular with several of the founders, including George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and particularly with the fourth Chief Justice of the United States, a fellow by the name of John Marshall, who was the first really prominent Chief Justice. And I happened to mention Madeira two or three times in class, and that sparked an interest in you. Is that a fair statement of how you got interested in it?
Yeah, that's a very fair statement. I agree, because...
So what did you do when I made all these mentions of Madeira wine?
First, when you mentioned Madeira wine, I really didn't know what you're talking about, and I got so interested in that. And I just decided to, you know, find out a little bit more about that, and I couldn't find it because the pronunciation that you use for this kind of wine is completely different from the pronunciation that we use. We call this wine Madeira wine because it comes from Madeira Islands,
right?
And so I guess you call this island how do you say?
I have no idea because I didn't know it had anything to do with an island. I have no idea whether I'm pronouncing it correctly. I mentioned it for a fairly specific reason, and that was not only because several founders mentioned it, and not only because it came up, but because John Marshall, that Chief Justice I mentioned, was a very successful Chief Justice because he was a good politician. He was able to charm a lot of his fellow justices of the court to vote his way, and part of his charm, I had learned from a visit to his house in mm-hmm. Richmond, was that he was the guy who always showed up with the wine. He literally had a cask on wheels that he would take with him when he would travel and when he would go to sessions of the court, and he would always bring it with him. And so he was always the guy who said, "Would you like some wine?" He's mm-hmm. kind of like the guy who shows up at the frat party with the beer. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves him. Mm-hmm. And so there actually is a constitutional nexus here. There's a connection. John Marshall was effective in part because he was a good host, and part of his being a good host was this Madeira wine. Exactly. So that's the mysterious Madeira wine. That's why I mentioned
it. Mysterious.
And so you picked up on the mystery. So now you get to tell me what you found out about this Madeira wine. You said something about islands?
Well, very, very interesting thing is that I would call it Madeira wine because
right.
that's the way I pronounce
okay.
it.
But there's an island called Madeira?
Exactly. There is an island called Madeira. It's a Portuguese island
mm-hmm.
Close to Morocco, to North Africa coast,
right.
North African coast, in Atlantic Ocean. And so because this is an island, this island, it actually consists from very volcanic soils because...
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a volcano.
Oh, okay.
And it's very interesting that in distant Atlantic island that you find that you are able to produce such a high quality wine. This is something very it's very unusual, I think, in the world of wine production because of the high humidity and a lot of rainfall,
These are things that normally you wouldn't want.
You normally wouldn't want for the grape production, but Madeira is an exception, and so start in 16th century, they started to produce a lot of Madeira wine, and in historical books, you can find a lot of proofs that wine industry was very well established in 16th century, and this was 200 years after they found this island.
Okay.
And actual location of Madeira Islands, there are three islands. It had very strategic position, or it used to have when actually people start to discover new continents.
Mm-hmm.
And so when
the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Italians were all some of the big early European explorers. And mm-hmm. so these people are all sailing right by these islands, I guess.
Exactly.
And that's the way to have an economy, is you have to have something you produce and export if you want to have a vibrant economy. And that mm-hmm. was their export, was this wine.
That was their export. But first, they were producing this wine and it was really nothing special. Like, according to some, like, historians, the wine was pretty, like, not very tasty. It was mm-hmm. very bulk table wine.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, when they loaded this wine on the ships, and first they were this wine was traveling to India because people were drinking this on their boats and in India. So colonizers.
So people would simply say, "We're heading out to India from Portugal. Let's stop at Madeira
exactly.
and pick up some wine.
Pick up some wine, and we'll have it on the way."
They were the convenience store.
It was a very convenient store because they have very good ports to
right.
actually park their ships. How they say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
and load. A lot of barrels full of wine.
Okay.
But what happened on the way to India, which is a long way, barrels were exposed to extreme heat and sun and a lot of, you know,
jostling around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so when these people try wine in India, they found out that wine like completely changed flavor and the color. And they found out they really like it that way.
They prefer it more than before. Now, see, now that's really a surprise because now I don't know anything about wine, but I guess what little I know is that generally speaking, you're supposed to store it in a cool, dry place,
exactly.
right? It's the antithesis of being in a hot, humid ship's hold going through the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
But that treatment apparently made it better.
Made it better. It's different from other grape varieties. Native grape varieties on Madeira produce wine that it's very resilient by itself. Plus, they figured out if they add some distilled sugar cane that extend the resilience of wine and they can transport it all the way to India. But what happened on the way, there was also a process of oxidation because, you know, the barrels were, you know, a little cracked and things. And so wine became a brown color because all the native grape varieties in Madeira are white except one that it's red, but it's not, they don't produce a high quality wine from that grape variety. And so the white wine that's supposed to stay white turned into brown color because of the oxidation. And also flavor changed and you got this caramel and scotch something flavor, and I'm very, very tempted to try this wine now.
Yes, in fact, that's always been something that I've wanted to do, but we'll get to that in just a minute.
Well,
so they discover that it tastes good.
They taste good.
Okay.
And so what were they doing? They also, first colonizers that colonized North America and West Indies, they took wine on ships with them.
Okay, now by the time that colonizing was going on, we're up to the 1500s, so the 16th century.
In 17th century, when the colonization of
the 1600s.
Okay,
so the 1600s, but I mean, just so we're all clear, I mean, I always get confused when people say centuries. So in the 1600s, and the colonizing is going on in the Americas.
Yes.
Now, by this time, had they figured out how to make it taste good by putting it in the holds of the ships? I mean, so now they really want to take it with them?
Actually, what happened, because people figure out that temperature aging influenced so well on this wine that it's very tasty after temperature aging. These people in Madeira, you know, started to think, you know, this is a very expensive process. If we have to put all these wine barrels to the ship and ship it all the way to U.S. and back, just to expose it to heat.
Started putting it in the holds of ships and bringing it back and forth?
Yeah, exactly.
Just
it was back and forth. They didn't just like unload wine in North America, but they brought it back and forth just for the aging process.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and today we're sharing a nip of wine. Why, you may ask? Why would we talk about this in a show about the Constitution? Because, as we were just discussing with young Maya, a graduate student at the University of Tennessee, a particular type of wine played a significant role, perhaps, in our constitutional history. It's called Madeira wine. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk some more with young Maya about Madeira. Stay tuned.
I've tasted the wines of France, and I've tasted the wines of Spain, and though many a wine is the same, there are none like the wines of Madeira. I've courted the girls of France, and I've courted the girls of Spain, and though most pretty girls are the same, there are none like the girls of Madeira.
Well, hello, boys and girls. It's time for our quiz. So get your pens and papers out and your special decoder rings and...
or just the Constitution.
Or just the Constitution.
Yeah,
get that pen and paper is actually useful because I have trouble keeping track of these things sometimes. Anyway, James Madison's Montpelier and the Center for the Constitution has once again graciously supplied us with its most precious asset, Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I am so happy to be here today, and I think we've got a contestant, don't we? Who's on the line?
This is Kenyatta.
Hello, Kenyatta. Where are you from?
I am from Fitzhugh, Georgia, but I'm attending school, law school in Grundy, Virginia.
I see. Well, Kenyatta, we're so happy to have you with us here today and very happy you called in. And, of course, studying law is a wonderful thing.
We have a law school ringer today.
We have a law school student. We're very happy to have her. But you're from Georgia, and I thought I heard a little bit of Georgia in that accent.
Yes, sir.
All right. Are you ready to rock and roll here?
I am ready.
All right. Kelly, you have a question for Kenyatta?
I do, Kenyatta. I have a question related to the Seventh Amendment today.
The Seventh? Oh, man.
I know. We don't talk about... We're getting into amendments that are...
This is an obscure
ones that we don't really talk about all that often.
Okay, it's going to be a hard question, Kenyatta. Yeah. I hope you're ready.
Yeah.
Okay, what is it?
All right. The Seventh Amendment provides that all civil trials shall be by jury when, A, when requested by the plaintiff in a writ of mandamus.
Okay, a writ of mandamus,
mandamus.
I think. I think that's the way that they pronounce it, but it's a Latin word, so I really don't know how the Romans pronounced it. But anyway, go on.
All right. B, in cases where there is a danger that judges may award excessive damages to a plaintiff. C, when the value in controversy is deemed by Congress to merit special consideration. Or D, when the value in controversy shall exceed $20.
Okay, those are interesting answer choices. Can we take the...
Hopefully Kenyatta has a constitution with her. that would help out in this case.
Yeah, would. All righty. Let's go through them one by one, Kenyatta. And what is the question again?
The Seventh Amendment provides that all civil trials shall be by jury when A, requested by the plaintiff in a writ of mandamus.
Okay, so do you have to request a trial by jury with a writ of mandamus? Is that what's required by the Seventh Amendment, Kenyatta?
I don't think, not by a writ. I don't believe so.
Okay, so A doesn't sound good. Okay, then B? What's B, Kelly?
In cases where there is a danger that judges may award excessive damages to a plaintiff.
So if we need a jury to keep those judges under control, is that what the Seventh Amendment says?
No.
No.
She thinks you're trying to fool with her on that one. Okay, what about a C, Kelly?
C, when the value in controversy is deemed by Congress to merit special consideration.
Special consideration. So I guess for high value trials, is that what we're saying?
Perhaps.
Maybe that's what the Seventh Amendment says. If Congress says a certain trial is going to have a high value, then we have to have a jury. What about that, Kenyatta?
It sounds okay, but I'm not really certain.
She's a, want to D. She is a picky, picky contestant. What do we think? She I is. Hope D's good. I don't know. What was D again?
When the value in controversy shall exceed $20.
I think I would rather go with D over C.
You think the Constitution sets a dollar limit on jury trials?
$20 at that?
$20?
That gets us nowhere.
Man, I'll tell you what, filing fees are more than $20. Is that your answer, Kenyatta?
I really wanted to go with A at first, but that writ is what really threw me off, so...
That writ threw you off.
A writ. We have a law student here. What is a writ for those of us who don't know?
Yeah, what's a writ?
Well, I can't really explain it. It's one of those things that you just know, but you can't really put it in words.
And it just doesn't have anything to do with juries, though. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I feel, yes, sir.
So you're going to stick with that $20 limit in choice D, are you?
Well... I think I am.
She thinks she is. So does Kenyatta have it correct? Does the Seventh Amendment require a trial by jury in any civil case worth over $20?
Believe it or not, it does.
Kenyatta, well done. Kenyatta, that's exactly right. And you know, despite my attempt to make that sound like a silly provision, it is. It's right there in the Constitution. It might be the only monetary reference, you know, specific money reference in the Constitution. I might be wrong on that. I've never actually read through it with that in mind. But it always struck me as odd that, you know, you simply say that anything above $20. I know it was a lot worth
a lot
more money.
Different time period when it was said. But it does say in suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved.
Yeah. So if you want a trial in a civil case, basically in any civil case in federal court, you get to have it. And that's absolutely remarkable. So, Kenyatta, congratulations.
Well done, Kenyatta.
You get a T-shirt.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking about wine, specifically the mystery of Madeira wine, a type of wine that's significant in our constitutional history. I'm talking to Maya Giorgio, who is a graduate student of wine geography at the University of Tennessee, and she is just now telling us about the special aging process that produces this unusual type of wine.
What happened consequently, they developed their own approach how to age wine with temperature. Mm-hmm. They put wine into wooden barrels, mm-hmm. and they just put it in the sun, and it aged very, very slowly. But then, you know, as technology developed, they figured out that maybe they can expose wine into the steam or into hot water to age it faster. Mm-hmm. Well, wine was not that wine was not high quality, but still people loved it. So till nowadays, it's this procedure still going on there. So they age wine with temperature, and they have three different aging process. One is with hot water, and one is with steam, and one is on the sun. And this aging process on the sun lasts like up to 20 years.
They stick it out in the sun in the tropics for 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
Wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's so this very interesting.
So this becomes popular in the United States, or in the colonies, and then
so
the United States.
First colonizers brought this wine there. They were drinking this in bulk. The main port that they were unloading this was Savannah port. Mm-hmm. And why Savannah? It's very interesting because here it's very dry and humid, mm-hmm. very hot and humid. And because it's very hot, they were able to put barrels outside on the sun and, you
just
know,
leave them there.
Leave them there. It was also a very funny story that I read that when this wine was exposed to all the different weather conditions, a lot of water came in the barrel, so it was kind of diluted sometimes. But people didn't mind. The way they sell this to people, they just said, oh, this is just a new grape variety, a new wine from Madeira. And they were like, wow, that's this new, fresh something. It's a summer wine. It was called rain wine. And they liked it. They loved it. It's very, very
so
interesting.
Colonial marketing techniques. You've got rain-damaged wine, so, it's a new variety.
It is.
You charge more for it.
So if we talk about why is this so important for America is... Like, right now, America is, I think, like, first in the world in consumption of wine. Mm-hmm. But who started all that was one of the members of the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. He was actually, like, the first who was, like, he was called the wine geek of the founder of fathers and the wine connoisseur. And so he was educating all other founding fathers about the wine, taking them to France, taking them everywhere. And what he really wanted to do, he wanted to grow grapes here. Well, he found out that Vitis vinifera, which is a European grape variety, doesn't produce very well here. So he started to grow, actually cultivate the native grape varieties that they grow and produce well here in United States. Well, of course, wine was not that good as in Europe, but he was convinced that United States wine will become a very successful wine producing country. And, you know, behind that is just very important, you know, meaning, symbology of how he actually started the wine industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had not realized he was the progenitor of the wine industry.
And he believed in that so much that in his plantation in Virginia, I think it's called Montepulciano?
Monticello.
Monticello. Uh-huh. Monticello. Mm-hmm. He actually donated huge amount of money to Italian winemakers. So he brought Italian makers here and said, look, here's money. You can spend as much as you want. Just make sure you will do everything to make the best wine possible. So, you know, he brought here people with knowledge and try to, you know, produce very good wine. And that was kind of the beginning. I mean, of course, he was able to afford all that because mm-hmm. he has a lot of money. Like, I was reading all this, like, old stories about what was going on. He spent approximately, in today's dollars, mm-hmm. he spent $260,000 per year just on wine from Europe. Just on wine for
you. You know, and this is, again, it's significant. You know, Jefferson was historically and to some extent constitutionally. Now, Jefferson, as you say, spent a lot of time in Europe. He soaked up a lot of European culture in addition mm-hmm. to the European wine. He did take tours of the wine country in France and perhaps other places as well. And I had not realized that among his many agricultural experiments, mm-hmm. there was this massive investment in wine. Here's the relevance of it, perhaps. And that is that Jefferson was, in one sense, very wealthy. Mm-hmm. He had lots of land, he had lots of property, including lots of slaves. That made him a wealthy man, and yet he consistently lived beyond his means. Mm-hmm. And that expenditure on wine, one might call a non-essential expense, and it might have been one of the many reasons. In fact, I've seen it cited as one of the reasons that he died in debt, and eventually Monticello was foreclosed on, I mean, and all the rest of it. So here was a guy who, I don't know exactly what the significance is of this, but his unwillingness to give up his Madeira wine certainly affected his finances, and I think it affected his outlook on finance generally. He was always very suspicious of bankers. Mm-hmm. He was always very suspicious of what he called the money men. Mm-hmm. And maybe it all comes back to the fact that he just liked Madeira wine too much.
He
really so that might it. Really have affected his entire states' rights outlook mm-hmm. simply by making him suspicious of the people he seemed to be enthralled to and all the debt that he accumulated. Anyway, that's a little bit of
it's
constitutional theory thrown into the wine.
He was bringing Madeira wine here, but that was just one of the wines that he was bringing here. Mm-hmm. He brought a lot of wine from France, but wine from France was mainly very dry wine. People loved sweet wine, and Madeira wine was sweet wine, especially because they didn't add distilled cane
sugar,
mm-hmm. but they add brandy. So actually, this just kind of gave a completely different flavor to that wine. It was even more flavorful than still cane sugar.
And I suspect it was more alcoholic, too.
It was very alcoholic.
Uh-huh.
It's like 20%. It's crazy.
No, what is most wine typically? Is closer to like 13 or 14%?
Yeah.
And just to contrast that, most beer is somewhere around 6% or so,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So, you know, maybe 6 to 10% for beer, you know, 10 to 13 or 14% for wine, and this was 20.
20 and plus. Yeah.
Sounds like so Thunderbird.
This wine is called fortified wine.
Fortified wine.
Yeah,
okay.
And it's one of the other fortified wine, like port in Portugal.
Uh-huh.
And a few others, not many, that they add actually distilled alcohol to wine.
I see.
It's really strong.
Okay, so Jefferson liked him some strong wine, as did the other founders.
And he was promoting this as something very healthy, and he was a really promoter of drinking wine as a health, to have a health impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they were like collecting all kind of different letters and, you know, trying to figure out where this wine was mentioned.
Well, it's also interesting, as I mentioned before, I first became aware of this when I heard about John Marshall's conviviality on the court. And now, now I understand that John Marshall is offering glasses of 20% alcohol.
Yes.
To his, maybe that accounts more for his success in persuading people than I realized. After a couple glasses of Madeira, I think you could be persuaded of almost anything. Good heavens.
Well, we have to also mention that Madeira wine was used as a toast when they signed the Declaration of Independence.
It was.
Well,
so it appears again in our history. Well, can I get myself some of this wine? Can I try some of this stuff?
Well,
I mean, that's what I've been thinking.
Definitely can. Well, if you would like to try some like wine from that period, you would pay several thousands.
Oh, you mean there's still Madeira wine in bottles sitting around?
Well, it is, but it's.
Okay, so when I make my millions, I can go out and buy some of
it. Exactly.
Okay.
We can try it together.
Okay,
please
good. I'll share it with you. Okay, I'll let you know when I buy that. Okay.
But if you would just like to try a wine from Madeira, yes, it's possible. I don't know if you can buy this in store in Tennessee. I haven't checked this out yet. But I know in Savannah, this wine is still very popular.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a Madeira tour there. When you go to Savannah, ask, I don't know, or Google before you go there for a Madeira tour, and they will take you to this historic house where they were serving Madeira, and they have Madeira parties, and they still have Madeira's parties.
Really?
The whole month of February, I think every weekend in February, they have Madeira parties, and I'm very tempted to attend this now.
I think maybe I can get the law school to pay for this as a research trip.
Exactly.
I see. We could go. Now, I do think, it seemed to recall that you told me something, however, about the Madeira wine vines being wiped out at one point.
Exactly.
Tell me about that incident.
Well, what happened after this huge success in 17th century or
1600s, 1700s, 1700s is most relevant.
We have
for
like
us.
Our own way to think about that.
I always mix them up, but that's okay.
Okay, so what happened after that? Unfortunately, in the middle of 19th century,
right, 1800s. Okay, yeah,
1800s.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big a problem because a disease called oidium came to the island, not just to that island, but all across the Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they finally figured out how to cope with this disease, well, they heavily spray that with sulfur, which they still do nowadays.
They spray the vines with sulfur?
Yeah, actually,
and
grape leaves. Because,
oh, okay.
Because this oidium, it's like a mildew disease.
Mm-hmm.
It actually destroys vine completely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they don't produce any grape at all. But after that, when they figure out how to cope with this disease, another one came and completely killed the entire, you know, vineyards all across the Europe. And they also brought this to Madeira through ships. You know, this spread out immensely. And so what happened, they just took root out. I mean, they just completely destroy all the vineyards, and they just replaced it with sugarcane.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with Maya Giorgio, who is a graduate student in, of all things, wine geography at the University of Tennessee. She's telling us all about Madeira wine and its constitutional significance. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll speak some more with Maya about Madeira. Stay tuned.
You have some Madeira, Madeira. You really have nothing to fear. I'm not trying to tempt you, that wouldn't be right. You shouldn't drink spirits at this time of night. Have some Madeira, Madeira. It's really much nicer than beer. I don't care for sherry, one cannot drink stout and port.
So Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, Mr. Madison is returning to Montpelier on September 8th during the hot summer months. James and Dolly would always left the muggy Washington weather to relax at Montpelier at their
smart people
beloved Virginia estate.
Anyone who has any brain leaves Washington, D.C., certainly in the summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, so Mr. Madison will be here on Saturday from noon to 5 in our Constitution room in the mansion. So he'll be talking about drafting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights while he's here. So we're excited to have Mr. Madison back.
Great. That setup is sort of like a mini lecture hall.
Yes.
And it's the first room most people enter, isn't it, when they come in?
It's off to the side.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's off to the side. It's not directly on the tour group, but it has a direct entrance off the south side of the mansion. Okay, well, that's something to look forward to. And when is that again, Kelly?
September 8th.
And that's a Saturday?
Saturday.
Saturday, September the 8th. Come and see Mr. Madison from noon to 5. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We're talking with Maya Giorgio about Madeira wine, a very constitutionally significant wine that had its ups and downs in the island of Madeira. Maya is just now telling us how the people of Madeira stopped producing the wine for a long time and then reproduced it using American vines.
So sugarcane was growing on Madeira for a while, until they figured out that they should bring American grape varieties to Madeira and Europe. And so they planted American grape varieties there, or did hybrids with some European grape varieties that survived.
Okay.
Well, what happened was...
So this is sometime in the 19th century that they're able to...
At the end of the 19th, yeah.
Okay, so the late 1800s, early 1900s, they're able to recover from this terrible disease by bringing American vines and American hybrids into Madeira and into Europe generally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we're reestablishing the Madeira wine.
And sales were good again, but not as successful as before. I mean, that was really golden age when these founding fathers here promoted wine. But after, I mean, like America, I mean, North America, like, bought every year one quarter of the whole wine produced in Madeira. Other went to India, and I think in Germany and UK. But what's very interesting, and I think it's important to mention, why Madeira wine? Because founding fathers were not able to bring, I mean, founding fathers, mm-hmm. I just really want to talk about Jefferson, because
okay.
he was
Jefferson.
Like very, very, he wanted to bring this wine here. He couldn't bring so much wine from France that he was able from Madeira, because exports of any goods were not allowed, like from Europe. So French wine was not allowed to be brought to British colonies here.
The mercantile system,
exactly.
Right? Okay, right.
And the Madeira Island was the exception. They didn't include it because nobody was thinking that they were, you know, growing so much.
Now
grape.
I see. So that partly
so
accounts
they
took for the popularity
of that.
Okay.
Exactly.
The islands of Madeira fell through the cracks in the mercantile system. So because they weren't prohibited, they were able to import. Okay, that accounts for a lot of its at least initial popularity. Okay, great. Yes.
But going back to the American grape varieties. Yes, they were producing a lot of grapes and wine again, but it was not that quality as before.
Okay, this is late 1800s, early 1900s.
It was, as they said, decent. They mm-hmm. survived. They were able to survive as an island, as an islanders. But then, in the beginning of 20th century, what happened was there was a Russian revolution in 1917, mm-hmm. And this really influenced the production a lot, because Russia was also a big consumer of this wine, mm-hmm. and at the same time have a prohibition happen here in 1920s till 1933, I think it was, right. Like the strongest. And this,
so you have a drop off in Russian consumption, mm-hmm. because of the revolution,
and
then in the United States you have prohibition starting at around 1920.
Yeah.
And so what does that do to Madeira wine?
Completely shut down the,
really?
The whole island. Like, production was zero because they had nobody to buy this wine anymore. So,
huh. So what Mother Nature couldn't do, the economy did in, yes. the 1920s. And so did they stop growing Madeira wine in the,
well,
1920s?
Well, they just very stagnated, and yes, a lot of people just moved out from the island, abandoned vineyards, and nothing was going on till the end of the 20th century, when they figured out, you know, what is really, what can really save us is to actually completely replant the vineyards again with our native grape varieties, because there were still a few, you know, that they were able to save them. And so when they again replanted all the vineyards with native grape varieties, they started to produce very high quality wine again, and they are doing this still today, till nowadays.
And so this had just happened in the last couple of decades then?
It's just, exactly. It just took a lot of time because the reputation was so bad that they were just using this as cooking wine. They were just cooking with that. But now the reputation grew, and they export a lot to France and to Japan. Japan is a big consumer, because especially of the high quality, this 20 plus year.
Interesting.
Aging.
So there are at least three periods I can think of. There was,
exactly.
the initial period of popularity,
mm-hmm.
then there was the disease that took them,
yes.
down, and then there was the recovery from that in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
and then Prohibition came along and the Russian Revolution,
yes.
and almost shut them down again,
mm-hmm.
and they stagnated throughout the 20th century, and then late in the 20th century they started producing again. Now, are they still using the heat methods? Of,
yeah, so right now there is this... they are allowed to just use native grape varieties in order to call wine from Madeira Madeira wine. If they are growing other grape varieties, they can. If they put other grape in this wine, they cannot call it. So it's very, very strict.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strict procedure, and it's controlled by, I think, European Union, because it falls under the Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's protected. It has a protected geographical origin.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I think they are back on the right track.
And so now they will harvest Madeira, they'll make the wine, and they'll put it in these barrels, and they will put it in the sun.
Yes, this is one of the procedures for like mass produced for high volume Madeira wine. They will still use just hot water around the stainless steel tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Or steam, so they will put it like this bulk of wine they will put in the steam rooms, and actually wine will age in the steam.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, otherwise they have it outside on the sun.
Well, that's just fascinating. Well, I know what I'm going to have to do now. I'm going to have to make a trip at some point to Savannah. And I'm going to have to go to one of these Madeira places where I,
yes.
can get the wine and maybe bring a bottle or two back.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can sample it. The University of Tennessee doesn't let us have any alcohol on campus.
So we'll need to do this out of the campus.
We'll have to do it off campus someplace at some time. But maybe next, maybe we can have the constitutional law class go and sample the Madeira wine at some point.
This would be very, very interesting. I hope I will be still here.
Okay. any final thoughts on Madeira wine before we finish up then?
Well, I really think it's fascinating how you know, something as wine, like that doesn't really, as we were talking before our radio show, unfortunately, prohibition completely destroyed the culture of wine drinking in U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, talking about the origin of drinking wine and wine cultivation in U.S., it's very important to actually bring the culture of wine drinking back. That this is just not as an alcoholic beverage, but, you know, in just to for pure pleasure and you know,
it's not just a way to get drunk.
But it has so
in fact,
much.
In fact, the people who are wine connoisseurs can date their wine connoisseur history at least back to Thomas Jefferson. So when you enjoy a glass of wine, perhaps a bit of cheese and good conversation with your friends, you're behaving as Jefferson would have you behave.
Yes.
So this is, wine drinking is patriotic.
It is. It's a very patriotic thing. I think it's very patriotic thing, and I think people should be aware of that and lessen the strict laws that prohibit drinking on places like campuses, where I think, you know, we should educate students about culture of wine drinking as so they will be able to develop like appreciation of that.
I see. So as part of the historical
yes.
education of
exactly.
students at the University of Tennessee, and especially at the mm-hmm. law school,
mm-hmm.
we need to repeal, to coin a phrase, the prohibition of alcohol on campus and instill a patriotic culture of wine connoisseurship, right?
Yes.
Well, I see that. I fully support this.
I do too.
And I think that we're going to have to try to, we'll have to get a petition up or something.
That's a
First Amendment right, you know, to petition our government.
Good,
and
yes.
we will cite Thomas Jefferson when we do so.
Exactly. He actually wrote a lot of, like, thoughts about wine, about his journeys to France, about cultivating wine here. And there's also a book written about that. It's, I think, Thomas Jefferson on Wine. It's the title
really?
Of the book.
I did not know that either.
Yeah.
Well, Maya, you have educated me on one corner of constitutional law and our constitutional history that I had very little knowledge about, and I suspect many of our listeners feel the same way. So thank you so much. In fact, before I let you go, you're heading off on a wine vineyard tour now, aren't you?
Yes.
Where is this going to take place?
Well, as a student here in the University of Tennessee, I decided to take some people from Tennessee to Slovenia to show them how we grow grapes there, produce wine, and so I decided to do that, and I will take 10 people to Slovenia this coming August. It's going to be 10 days long tour, and yeah, we're going to visit all three wine regions, and I think they will have a good sensory experience of Slovenia.
That sounds like a marvelous trip, and I wish I could come with you.
If this will be successful, we'll do another one next year, so you're very welcome to join us.
Maybe next year. My wife loves wine. Maybe we'll have to go and sample some Slovenian wine together. All right. Well, Maya, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you coming in and educating us.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Wasn't that a fascinating interview on an unusual constitutional subject, Madeira wine? You know, sometimes strange subjects arise, and then they just keep popping up wherever you look for them. And as I was preparing to produce this show, my wife, also known as the other Professor Harris, yelled out one evening as she was watching television in the kitchen. She likes to watch cooking shows, appropriately enough, in the kitchen, and one of them she likes to watch is one called Hell's Kitchen. And it's a contest sort of show, as many of these cooking shows are. And in this particular episode, apparently they were to try to identify several mystery ingredients. And you guessed it, one of those ingredients was Madeira wine.
In today's Taste It Now Make It Challenge, the final sex are competing in pairs to recreate one of Chef Ramsay's signature dishes.
You all pretty much nailed the dish.
The winners will be determined by one final detail.
In the sauce. There was something unique.
Wow. heart right now.
I know.
Barbie, Justin, Christina, Robin, you said port, right? Dana and Clemenza. You said a Madeira-based sauce. Dana Clemenza, you had the Madeira. Congratulations. Well done.
Yeah, baby. Yes. Totally.
Really well done indeed.
Boy, that was exciting. What suspense. Madeira wine strikes again. Now let's have our Madison Minute.
In September 1821, Albert Pickett Sr., Albert Pickett Jr., and John W. Pickett wrote to James Madison requesting his opinion of female education. The Picketts asserted, "If it be worthy of national concern to educate young men well in all that pertains to their morals and intellect, it is no less necessary to educate females in an equally solid, if not splendid, degree." While Madison's reply was brief, he responded favorably. "The capacity of the female mind for studies of the highest order cannot be doubted, having been sufficiently illustrated by its works of genius, of erudition, and of science." Madison clearly considered the mind of the fairer sex able and competent. Earlier that same year, he wrote to Reynolds Chapman that the study of geography and history was as valuable and becoming to women as it was to men. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Hey, podcast listeners, we love you. We love all of our listeners, and those of you who listen via podcast, via the miracle of the internet, you're all over the world. I've seen downloads in Iran. I've seen downloads in Australia, in Turkey. We've got lots of fans, it seems, in Ghana. All over the planet, Europe, Mexico, even Canada. Well, if you listen by podcast, something may not have occurred to you. We are a radio show. There are all sorts of public radio stations all over the country. I bet there's one near you. And there's a very easy way to listen to us on your public radio station. That's to call them up and tell them you want them to carry our show. It's very simple. In fact, you may already call them up periodically when your public radio station has a fund drive. If that's the case, if you are a contributor, and we hope you are, next time you're on the phone with them and they thank you for your contribution, say, "You're welcome. And you know what? You'd make me even happier, even more likely to contribute, if you'd carry your weekly constitutional." And if you make sure and tell them the name of the show and tell them to Google us, they'll go straight to our Facebook page, they'll go straight to our website, and then they'll be able to contact us, and we'll be very happy for them to carry our show. In fact, if you really want to write it down and think about it, you can give them our email address. It's ywc@montpelier.org. Once again, ywc@montpelier.org. So give them a call and you can start listening to us on the radio. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Maya Giorgio, a geography graduate student at the University of Tennessee, who told us all about Madeira wine. Thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, and thanks to our distribution engineers, Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.